Hello, and welcome to Spartan Speak, a podcast from the Atlantic State Journal and Detroit Free Press focused on Michigan State sports. I'm Phil Friend, your host and producer. Joining me this week are two sports writers who have spent the past 4 days sleep banking, Detroit Free Press beat writer Chris Lowry and Atlantic State Journal sports columnist Graham Couch. Well, I'm going to start with a listener question off the bat here, because Nick Mantis from WLNS wants to know, which of you guys are wearing compression socks when traveling to Seattle this weekend?
Is that a thing?
Both of us are. Sure. It'll keep the circulation going. Guys like us need them. We're up in advanced ages now once you get past 40. At least to millennials, 40 is the new 93, I think.
Graham, how you doing?
I'm good. I didn't know that was a thing. I mean, I have to purchase two seats because of my weight, so that's a whole different thing, but, you know.
Oh. Yeah, I don't agree. Come on, Graham. You're not pulling a Kevin Smith out there. You don't have to buy two seats for yourself.
Have you seen Kevin Smith lately? We should all be so lucky to lose that much weight.
Yeah. I'm trying. Good for him. I'm trying over here, especially after Graham called me out on Twitter last week.
Ooh,
what did I say?
I made the thing about after Malik Carr made that catch last week, I was like, Malik Carr is a beefy boy. And then you took a shot at my weight. I haven't forgotten.
Well,
I haven't forgotten, Graham.
I'm just saying, you probably shouldn't be calling people beefy.
Well, he is a beefy boy. He's a big dude. What's wrong with that?
I mean, listen, weight jokes are the bottom feeder jokes of any
worst.
Good comedy. Any one that tries to be funny. So
it's the worst. Weight jokes are the worst.
Well, let's just get into everything this week here. Besides the talk about sleep banking and compression socks and weird sleeping habits on your way to what is essentially like a 5-hour flight or whatever, like I think Graham, you were on a call, was like two movies. It's like, I don't know how much we need to adjust the sleep for that, but you know, it's sports, and like Mel did say earlier this week, there's some fine edges and fine lines between good and great, and you have to, you know, work in the margin. So maybe there's something to it. I guess we will find out late Saturday night. But I do not want to start there. I actually kind of want to start with Michigan State's quarterback situation regarding Peyton Thorne. There was a lot of hype for him in the offseason from everybody, and a lot of it was certainly warranted. He had a lot of bright moments last year, leading a team to an 11-2 record and a team that was, you know, in the college football playoff fight for a while. So, you know, there's expectations for being All-American and All Big Ten, people getting mad when he's not ranked as high as they thought he should be on some things. And then now here we are, two games into the season, and now he's, I don't know if he's answering questions from the coaches, but he's certainly answering questions from fans about maybe he doesn't look like he has taken that next step up that a lot of people expect him to take it. It feels like there's a little bit of Lewerke in there too, in terms of a lot of people expected him to take that big step after that. Was it 9-3? Yeah, because they flipped from 3-9 to 9-3. Yeah, his 9-3 season, and then he never took that step that a lot of people expected. Now here's Thorne two games in. He's hitting some deep balls, but he seems to be pretty inaccurate so far on the short to long range or short to medium range throws. And I guess, you know, I want to turn it over to you guys and just basically see, is the worrying warranted, or is it just two games and they're 2-0 and they've scored a ton of points, or is there a reason to think that Noah Kim might see some game action here against Washington? Graham, I want to start with you and get your two cents about all this.
I mean, there's no question he struggled, especially the intermediate stuff, some of the long developing stuff. And, you know, and it's interesting to try to figure out how much of that is receiver connection driven. I think the number of those balls that have been to Keon Coleman over two games is noteworthy. A couple to Jeremy Bernard. Zero of his off-target passes to Jaden Reed last week. Now he's had a couple of balls that weren't perfect. Jaden Reed had to go get one, including the one where he got dinged up there. But there's something to that. Guys not being in the right places, necessarily young receivers. And so I don't know what's what, and it's hard to get a clear sense of that entirely. I thought he finished the game well, and his final couple drives, especially his final drive. And so I don't think there's, you know, obviously this is something where if it lingers and he throws a couple picks every game and he's off target considerably and it starts to cost them, then you have to have discussions. And I don't think Mel Tucker to this point looks like somebody who's all that sentimental about, you know, I mean, the best guy is going to play. I also think if, you know, if somebody else was better in practice, teammates would know that. Everybody would know that, and that sort of thing would happen. But, yeah, no, I don't know yet that it's a huge point of concern. I think this week helps that it's one of those games where you have to play to a certain level just to win. And if you do win, it really doesn't matter how you play, because if you win, you played well enough. And I think they need one of those games a little bit where what's appreciated isn't the statistical line or the perfection, but the result.
Yeah, there's no quarterback controversy, first of all. I mean, the thought that anyone thinks that they would put in Noah Kim at this point, particularly just two games into the season, is kind of misguided. I think, to me, it's a little bit, you know, when you're working with another new receiver in Coleman, it's kind of like in spring training when a pitcher will go through and work on his other stuff in those games, because first of all, those games don't matter. It's a little different in college football. I mean, every record and every game matters, but you know, both of those games were fairly well in hand, even though it took until the fourth quarter with the Western game. But I think he was purposely going to Keon Coleman a little bit more and away from Jaden Reed, because they got to develop that chemistry. And, you know, we haven't really seen many throws to Trey Mosley, who he has good chemistry with. So I think that's kind of part of it. I think part of it, you look at who he's throwing to, and he was trying to break in a couple new tight ends, trying to break in Coleman, trying to break in the backs out of the backfield. And, you know, some of the things that he was doing with Reed, you know, obviously the one deep shot that you mentioned where Reed got hurt, you know, that was maybe one of the few deep balls he's thrown to Reed. I mean, a lot of the stuff they've done is around the line of scrimmage through motion and, you know, kind of getting them on swing passes. So that's a different element to their offense that you're trying to get in the system and get in rhythm with. So I don't think you'd get too worried about some of those things. And even what he's got, four touchdowns and three interceptions, all three of those interceptions came under duress. The first one came, it was a bad decision to throw back across his body, but he had a guy in his face in the Western game. And in both of the other ones, one was a delayed blitz and one was a missed picked up blitz. So some of that is working with the offensive line in front of him. So, you know, those are timing elements that I think iron out once you get through it into a game situation. You know, if anything, I don't think the throws are as questionable as maybe a couple of decisions, because even Thorne talked about, you know, I got to know when to take a sack in those two that he threw against Akron, because the guy was right there and he tried to make a play, but didn't, with someone in his face. So I think that's part of it. I think those are all kind of come together, but there's no quarterback controversy at this point, regardless of what Noah Kim did against Akron, which was a team that, you know, if Noah Kim goes out there and start, they maybe win 41-0.
I agree with you, Chris. I don't think there's a quarterback controversy, nor will there be at any point in the season. That doesn't feel like a bold take necessarily.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, there very well could be if this persists. Yeah. You know, if there's not timing with the receiver. I mean, you think back to the 2013 season, Maxwell came in and had been throwing, you know, bullet after bullet after bullet off guys' hands and struggled. And, you know, a guy that comes in Connor Cook eventually developed some rhythm because he had been working with some of the guys who elevated their play from the number two receiver spot and became important factors along with the starter. So, you know, it can happen. It absolutely can happen, but I don't think it's anywhere close to happening at this point.
And one of the things that, you know, if you go back to that, you know, almost a decade now, that Maxwell competition and how that all unfolded with Connor Cook, and really beginning in that Buffalo Wild Wings Bowl, you know, Cook was 4-for-11 in that game. But what you could tell was the offense just moved better with him. And I think sometimes the thing that happens, you just see it, and I think we'll know it. Like if the offense stops moving with Peyton Thorne and he's missing opportunities on key downs, then that becomes a conversation. He's turning the ball over or things like that. I think at this point, you know, people talk about the touchdown pass that Kim threw, which is a nice throw. But, I mean, Peyton Thorne did that against Penn State his sophomore year. I mean, Peyton Thorne did more his sophomore year than Noah Kim's done yet. And so the idea that somehow that would propel Kim above him, again, we're not seeing practice. We're not privy to those conversations. I don't think that's right now at all where heads are within that program. That's not my sense.
And you know what else we haven't seen? Any design Peyton Thorne runs, and that's an integral part of his game and the offense last year. So that's something that gets him in a rhythm and gets him in a rhythm when he gets on the move as well and tries to make throws.
No, I agree with you there, Chris. Like, I do not think Jay Johnson's done a great job of helping him get into a rhythm game early in games. They haven't had a lot of quick rhythm type throws. They haven't done things that have, you know, now some of it's been on Peyton, like one of his lesser, not great overthrows last week was a play where just with tunnel vision completely ignored a wide open receiver running across the middle closer to him for an easy first down and threw a, you know, difficult cross the field, long out, overshooting. That's a play where it was there for him, and so there's options. And I think against Washington especially, you have to take that. But getting into quick things, too, where, you know, using those tight ends, using, you know, players you trust in spaces, the Trey Mosley's of the world, assuming Jaden Reed's going to play, and getting him feeling good about himself. The thing, you know, when I went back and watched – again, I actually thought Thorne played pretty well in the final stages of his stint in the game, and had a couple throws at the end that were terrific, including one where he was taking a hit. And so they just got to get him there earlier. And I think, you know, it's not like he's just way off the mark consistently, and it got worse and worse and worse, and he's lost his confidence, or he's got the yips or something like that. I mean, the throws he threw late were exactly what you need from him. And so you just got to find a way to get him going in the first quarter.
And that goes with what you were saying as well. I mean, the offense was still moving and, you know, the run game was going, and you got to get that established, I think, early. Like I said, there wasn't much of a chance for Michigan State to lose those first two games, particularly with Western breaking in a new quarterback. And particularly after DJ Irons got knocked out of that game against Akron, I think that, you know, you had to kind of, I think what Thorne did was work on some of the things that he knew he needed to work on or try to. And those other things, the thought will be, they will be there still from last year.
Yeah. My opinion is that I think Thorne's basically just so far the same quarterback he was a year ago. It's just that people raised expectations for him, maybe perhaps a little too far than they should have, which is something I think we do here in the state of Michigan, and based on that other school down the road where after one game, I saw a video with Braylon Edwards or whatever talking about, is J.J. McCarthy going to be like the best quarterback in Michigan history? It's just like, what are we doing here? All fan bases are very capable and do this stuff often, but I was just like, what are we doing here? You know, the Taylor 12... viral video. What are we doing here? It's a little ridiculous. So I guess when I said I don't think there will be QB controversy the rest of the year, I think Thorne's going to be fine. I think Michigan State's going to be just fine and whatnot. Graham, I want to go back to something you said right at the beginning of this conversation where you talked about, you know, targeting Keon Coleman. For the second straight week, Coleman was the leader in targets with 8. So obviously that is, you know, something either they're trying, you know, to make an important part of the offense, or maybe, as Chris said, you know, it's bullpen warmups to try to, you know, integrate him into the offense and be a nice little complement there for Jalen or Jaden Reed.
Well, I also think, yeah, I mean, he's potentially a big time playmaker. I mean, yeah. You just look at what he is physically. And so I think that they're trying to utilize him and create a connection there. And he, you know, if you're a coordinator or anybody and you look at the matchup, you know, you're going to see a favorable matchup with him more times than not, especially when Reed's out there, because Reed is going to be the one that, you know, gets the top corner, the lion's share of attention. I mean, Coleman ought to have certain advantages. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, one of the things that Peyton Thorne mentioned was that post route where he, you know, Coleman was nowhere near open. In fact, the other guy was out in front of him. and he threw it anyway. I think there's this belief, because I do think in practice Coleman's been impressive, and so I think there's this sort of throw it out there, let him make a play mentality a little bit, and you got to be careful with that. It's not that you don't want to let him make plays, but you're going into a part of your schedule now where mistakes, you know, it's the old line about more football games are lost than won, and as you can say, there's a lot of playmakers and a lot of toys to play with and a lot of different ideas to bring to the forefront. But ultimately, you know, if you get too cute, you know, you're going to play teams where you could lose.
I think, you know, with the Coleman thing as well, there was kind of a little sneaky development that's been off the radar. I mean, people forget that Montori Foster was the starter at the end of last season, and he missed the first game, came back a little last week against Akron and got some work. I think that's kind of big because, you know, he gives you a different kind of receiver that can give you some of those underneath things and you know, kind of, you know, he was the guy that filled in for Jalen Naylor last year. It wasn't Coleman. So I think people just kind of forgotten him and, you know, maybe opposing defenses as well.
I did not go back and watch all of Thorne's throws all that closely, but I did see a couple people mention on Twitter that he was thrown off his back foot maybe a little too much. I don't know. Is that something you guys noticed when he was under pressure perhaps, or even not under pressure, or is that just something we sometimes try to talk about on Twitter to sound smart?
I mean, he was under pressure. I think there's some of it. Some of that's legit. I mean, both of those interceptions with guys hitting him and taking big shots. So, you know, is it Kirk Cousins' sophomore year or junior year where he was throwing off his back foot all the time? Probably not that bad. But, you know, again, like to me, I can't stress it enough that, you know, when you see the new receiver getting more targets than the established guy, and really more snaps than the established guy in Mosley and Reed, that kind of tells me that they were trying, as Graham said, to get that chemistry working. So when they get into the teeth of the schedule, it's there and he can be, you know, maybe people are putting a little too much expectations on what Keon Coleman can and should be in this offense, because honestly, he should be the number three receiver. That's ultimately what it is, because you've got two guys who are proven in Reed and Mosley, and maybe even the number four if Foster comes back healthy and can do some things, but and emerge as a guy who can end up being a number two or number one by the end of the year.
Yeah, or maybe Michigan State should just quit with the short to intermediate stuff and just run four verts every play, every game, and see how that works.
Now there's some footwork.
That's right.
There's some footwork issues though, and he, you know, it was evident in the bowl game, and he was talked about it. And you know, there are times where he's not under extreme pressure, but he doesn't step in, and so that's something he's got to be cognitive of or cognizant of, whatever the word is.
You got the second time.
Thank you. Words are what I do, so, you know.
That's okay. Have you ever listened to me talk on here? I stumble over my words every 5 seconds, so.
I have subtitles for your part of this, so I can actually know what's being said.
All right, well, let's move on to Wisconsin Wisconsin. See, this is what I'm talking about, Wisconsin.
It came across the subtitle said Washington. I knew what you meant.
Exactly. Let's talk about Washington for a little bit. Graham, you talked about this quite a bit in your column. A lot of Miami vibes this week, although Tucker tried to downplay them quite a bit, but also I don't know why, because there definitely is Miami vibes, especially with the way he's talking about this sleep banking and trying to get the bodies ready for this very difficult West Coast trip. Very difficult in quotations on my end. West Coast trip, but... I mean, what are we thinking about this thing, this game? Concern isn't the right word, but what's up with do we think they're overthinking this a little bit with this or what?
Well, no, I mean, I think you try and get everything you can out of the sleep science. Do I think it's always necessary? No, but I mean, I think teams with better players usually win regardless. But if you don't know if you have better players and you don't know the difference is all that much, you try to create every edge and everything you can. And if you have the resources to do it, you might as well. I mean, I covered junior college hoops for a little while, and, you know, teams would ride a bus 3 hours, put their McDonald's bags down, get there 20 minutes before tip-off sometimes, take the court and play just just as well, and they were used to it. And you know, but you're better off getting there the night before, having a good meal 4 hours before, being rested. You know what I mean? In right. theory, you know, those things matter. But I do think there are the opportunity, just, you know, the conditions will be different. It's going to be 30 degrees cooler and all that stuff. It's not the same thing. But it is a game where last year it was like, huh, this team has a little something to them. And there's some stuff under Mel Tucker's program that may be working in terms of preparation and performance and the way they finished that game. And so it sort of set the tone and was a defining characteristic in certain ways. And so I do think this has a chance to have some of those sort of things as well. If they go in there, they play well, they win, it'll set a tone and it'll create swagger. I mean, Cal Halliday said it gave them confidence. I think it changed the way they thought about themselves. And, you know, one of the things that is true that Mel Tucker said, and players, every team is new. You got to do it all over. And especially when, you know, so much of your roster and the key guys are new too. That what defines you, the defining traits, you know, have to be proven all over again.
Well, I think one thing that I would say completely differs to me in these two games is the quarterback that they're going to face. I think that Michael Penix is a better quarterback than De'Aaron King and has shown it at the Power 5 level, where King was playing for a Houston team and doing some things, you know, in the American Conference that maybe didn't translate to Power 5 football, and Michigan State's defense really kind of put it to him. And so that's, I think, one thing that does need to happen in this game, similar to the Miami game. They have to get after the quarterback. I mean, they've done a good job of it so far this season, but again, you're talking about a first-year starter and a backup that they've faced really for the bulk of these first eight quarters of football. And Michael Penix has worked with Kalen DeBoer when they were at Indiana. DeBoer now is the head coach at Washington, so they've got a relationship, they've got a rapport. And more importantly, the head coach, who's an offensive guy, knows how to put him in position to succeed. So if Michigan State's defense can get after Penix, which they struggled to do when they faced him with the Hoosiers, but if they can do that and make his life miserable, then I think you can see a similar outcome. But that's going to be a little bit of a challenge, I think. I think that's a big difference to me. It doesn't matter how much sleep you get or don't get, you know, you got to be able to pressure that quarterback, who's the key playmaker for them.
Yeah, and I think DeBoer is a better coach than you know, they faced in Miami last year. And, you know, what DeBoer did so well in that 2019 game. And, you know, 2019 Michigan State, people talk about how that fell apart. But when they played Indiana, that was before the Ohio State game. Like, you know, hope was high and life worth living. I mean, they thought they had something. And they were, I think they were a really good defense at that time. And what happened was the way that they designed it's obviously within the framework of the offense, but they almost baited the brush in. It was almost, I don't want to say it was like screen passes all the way, but they had a counter for everything that Michigan State did. And it was the defense was frustrated. It was like they thought they were getting there, and then boom. And so, you know, obviously you got different coordinators, different Michigan State defense, different playmakers everywhere, but that was interesting, and so that's a challenge as a pass rush and as a defense when you're facing a savvy coach who, you know, has had some experience creating some really successful counters that worked for his quarterback.
You know, what's interesting about DeBoer too is that he's kind of equipped for teaching the game the way it is right now. I mean, I've known the guy for about 20 years, back in my days in Sioux Falls when he had just got done as a All-American wide receiver at the University of Sioux Falls.
Everybody take a drink.
Arena. Well, no, I didn't say anything about Western Michigan.
Sioux Falls had the same policy.
It does. It does. I don't say it as much, but it's also not nearly as relevant until we start talking about Brad Salem and Kalen DeBoer. He worked in the Arena League, so he kind of cut his teeth there, which, you know, you got to get the ball out quick, and it's a pass-based league. Then he went and took over his alma mater, which was a highly successful NAIA program. and led them to national titles as both a player and a coach, which is pretty amazing. And then, you know, helped them kind of get into that. They left NAIA for Division II, and then he started his real coaching journey after that, and kind of bounced around a lot of the lower level Division I's and quickly rose up. You know, worked at Fresno State, then he went to that Indiana staff, and really, I think he what he did was give Tom Allen something that they didn't really have in offense there. You know, they had great defenses for Allen, but their offense struggled until DeBoer got there, really got them rolling, and then took off and got the head coaching job at Fresno, and then, you know, now lands the job at Washington. And what's he do? First thing is he goes to the portal and brings in the quarterback he's familiar with, who's a veteran, has a lot of Power 5 experience. So that's a savvy coach, but he also understands the landscape a lot, like Mel Tucker. You know, this is what you got to do to be successful. You got to bring in the players that you know and need and can help you right away to, if you want to make an impact now instead of 3-4 years down the line.
And Graham alluded to this earlier, but Michael Penix does have at least one game on tape of him lighting up the Michigan State defense. So we'll see if we get a repeat performance of that this year on Saturday. Or
two, really?
Two, you think two? Okay. I mean, it's been a while. I seem to remember the second one wasn't as good as the first one, but I'm not
sure. Yeah, it wasn't. You're right. 2020, you know, wasn't. I mean, right. Indiana was just a better team than Michigan State that year, and it's amazing how that program isn't what they were. But that was a 24-0 game where Michigan State wasn't. Indiana was just in this moment in their football program where they were in a different class than Michigan State, and Penix was part of that, but not so much the decider. If that right. makes sense,
right.
You know, he's had an injury history at Indiana, was in and out of the lineup there. I think missed last year. He was, you know, on the sideline for the game against Michigan State because he was hurt, and you know they were able to knock out DJ Irons last week and get to the backup. So, and they did that. He didn't get knocked out, but they knocked around De'Eric King and really changed the tone of that game at Miami. So I think if they're able to get the Penix, that's the way you disrupt it all. I can't stress it enough that, you know, you get to that guy and don't allow him to beat you, then you've got your best chance at success.
Whatever else we got to say about Michigan State and Washington, we can kind of weave into listener questions from here on out. And I'm going to start with Chuck Nichols, who asked, how surprised are you at MSU leading the nation in sacks through two games, Chris?
I'd say a little bit, because obviously you lose your top three defensive ends. That's a big deal. I mean, you know, you've got a couple D linemen that are out as well, and that's kind of a big deal. But I think what you've seen with that, first, the emphasis on it. That's something that Mel Tucker wanted to happen, and when he made that move to change from Ron Burton to bring in Marco Coleman and a dedicated pass rush specialist in Brandon Jordan, and he wanted to get to the quarterback more. It didn't necessarily, you know, that when you had, you know, what, it tied for, I think, seventh in the country last year in sacks, and there was good pass rush talent, but you lost most of that with Panashuk and Beasley and Drew Jordan. Those are the top three defensive ends. And now you bring in two transfers in Winman and Bogle, who, again, they've played competition that's much better than the two teams that they've played. How are they going to do against bigger Power 5 tackles coming off the edge? Winman, to me, I think his quickness and the moves that he's had and shown, really, he's an elite pass rusher, and I think he's been noted nationally for that a couple times already this year, and, you know, potentially more. But, you know, that, again, the minute that Akron game ended, they're not going to face a defense that bad the rest of the season, or an offense that bad the rest of the season, offensive line. So those guys have to continue that pressure. The guys in the middle, you know, with Slade and Barrow, need to collapse the pocket like they have been. And, you know, Slade was dinged up a little last week. Maverick Hansen was dinged up. Both those guys came back. So they need to kind of have a healthy push in the middle to keep those guys on the edge, getting to the quarterback.
Yeah, Winman is awesome. Again, that's not very deep analysis, but that dude's been amazing. And I think the unofficial trade between UNLV and Michigan State for Jacoby Winman and Rookie Wright has worked out for both parties. All right, I got three questions here from Andrew Gothier Gauthier, if you're fancy. First question, can we expect to see MSU use its tight end substantially more this week? Seems like a clear area of strength that they've just scratched the surface on. Graham?
Yeah, I mean, I would expect that when there's a need for those guys, you'll see it more, although I would expect it even – I mean, you saw a little more in the Western Michigan game, and it seems like that's a real strength that they ought to. Now, you got to take what's there, but I don't know which one of them creates, you know, the most opportunities or gets the most opportunities. But I just think that's an area where MSU is going to have a distinct advantage most weeks. And it's got better tight ends than most teams. And now I don't think that, you know, it's not a, you know, I mean, Malik Carr is probably the best long-term NFL prospect, and he's still a guy who's developing. Daniel Barker's the guy who looks the part and certainly has made the best-looking catches to this point. And then Tyler Hunt's just developed into a really good player. But, to me, those guys should be used a ton. But it's also on Thorne to do so. Those guys don't seem to be the check down all that often. They seem to be used in certain plays. And I'm a little surprised by that. Like, to me, those guys are really good weapons to have not only plays for, but as your check down. And we haven't seen that yet a lot.
I think you say some of that is based on the play calling and the opponents that they had. They didn't really necessarily need to. They were able to run the ball, so you didn't need the tight ends to really soften up the middle because you were able to get it done in the run game.
Yeah, I will note that between the three of them, they only combined for three total targets last week, two for Hunt and one for Carr and none for Barker. And we'll see if they get integrated more into the offense as the season goes along. I seem to remember Connor Hayward being a much bigger part of the offense at the beginning of their last year than we've seen so far. But
well, they also started with a conference game last year, too. I think that's something to keep in mind as well. I mean, you have to start when you're on the road playing a Big Ten team. You have to start with your full quiver. Whereas when you've got two opponents that are inferior, I don't like us usually saying that, but I think that's probably the best way to describe it. Those were inferior opponents. You don't necessarily have to use everything that you have in your arsenal. You can kind of meet it out as you need to. And I think you saw more targets in the Western game than you did in the Akron game. But part of that is I think Western's defense was better too. I think of the three teams or of the teams that those two, that Michigan State and Washington have played, Western probably has the best defense of all of them.
Assuming opponents will be paying way more attention to Windman going forward, can we expect to see other DE's rushers start to rack up sacks, or will this stymie the pass rush? Chris?
Well, I think you already started to see that in the Akron game with that Cal Halliday sack. I mean, they were so concerned about what Windman was doing on the other side that, you know, under Tuffler didn't even pay attention to the free blitzer coming from his front side, not even his backside. I mean, Halliday had a clear run. No one picked him up, and quarterback was tunnel vision looking towards the other direction because he knew that that's where the pressure had been coming from. So I think you've already seen that. You've seen some of those things as well with Vogel getting some of the things that some of the plays that he's made coming after Windman has come off the edge and flushed the guy. So yeah, I still think the attention's going to be on Windman, but there's opportunities there for the guys like Halliday and Vance Sumrin and Bogle and the other defensive ends to make some plays.
While MSU has run the ball effectively, they don't appear to have been dominant on the O-line versus lesser competition. Is this a concern going forward, or can we expect similar play against Big Ten foes? Graham?
You're talking about the offensive line, Michigan State has not been dominant, is what
yes.
They're saying? No, they've run, you know, the two main backs have averaged a combined 6.2 yards a carry at this point. So I think the backs look for real. Like, it's very clear at this point to me that Berger and Broussard are two guys that can get it done. It's a really nice tandem, and I think that'll carry over regardless of competition. What happens when the competition gets better is the question is, are there creases and holes for them, and does your offensive line do a whole lot? And you know, I like the potential of parts of that line when they're healthy. I like the three guys in the middle there, and there's some things that they've done well, and they've looked pretty good at times in the last 2 weeks. And you know, Washington is a team that that was not great against the run last year. Had some tackling issues a little bit against Kent State. But it's definitely a step up. So I think we learn a little bit there. Are those creases still there? I think it has a chance to be an okay running game, but we just don't know yet. There were no red flags in the first, 2 weeks that said it was a problem. Not like in 2017, they played Bowling Green up off the top and they can't run the ball. And it's like, okay, that's an issue. That's Bowling Green. You can't run the ball. And so those are all, that stuff that still has to be, proven in these next few weeks. And, but I don't see anything yet that makes you go, it can't happen.
I will say the one thing I did like was they were able to grind a team down like they were supposed to. You saw the wear and tear in the third and fourth quarters on both Akron and Western Michigan with what the front did. And that's something that bodes well, but you got to be able to get that up front and consistently against a Power Five opponent that's going to be pushing back on you just as hard and not wear down. So that's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, and the other thing, the short yardage, and sometimes this stuff happens when I do these quick takes right after a game, and you're not 100% sure why something broke down, and you go back and look at it. Like the fourth and one was poorly blocked, and that was Tyler Hunt missing a block. And the tight end is part of the offensive line. But that wasn't the crux. That's not like the interior of the line collapsed. You know what I mean? Like that wasn't. And sometimes it can be a tight end or receiver who screws something up in a run fit, and that's what it was in that particular play. So, but there have been a couple times where they haven't been able to impose their will, and we'll see going forward.
Briefly agree with you, Graham, and both. I don't think there's much concern, and very excited to see what the two running backs, Berger and Broussard, do this week. It seems like that they're filling in for Kenneth Walker here, or filling in replacing Kenneth Walker just fine here so far. They look like exciting runners who can do multiple, sort of the similar things that Walker did a year ago.
I actually looked it up, and they're actually combined averaging more yards right now than Walker did through two games last year. He averaged, I think, 160 and a half, and they're over about 181 combined. But again, you also take a look at the opponent that he put the bulk of those yards up and how few carries he got against Youngstown State. So take that with a grain of salt.
Alex Brandon asks, it was concerning to watch Irons rip apart the defense last week. Was MSU doing anything schematically to test out, quote unquote, different defensive calls, players knowing that the game would be won, or did Akron actually find a hole after one game of film?
Well, I think Irons is a very similar kind of player, a poor man's Michael Penix in some ways, because he was able to be a kind of a dual threat guy, and they obviously took it to him. So again, like I said, you got to get that kind of pressure to disrupt and maybe dislodge a quarterback from the spot. I'd be concerned. They were able to move the ball fairly efficiently and fluidly early in the game through the air, but that's when Michigan State's ability to hit and dislodge the ball came into play. I mean, they forced a bunch of fumbles. I think they had, four forced fumbles six fumbles and recovered four of them. Three of those were by Jacoby Windman, who is not just a hard hitter. He's got really good and quick hands as well. I think there's probably a little bit of concern with that, because they were able to move a little bit early on, but those drives also resulted in 0 points and minimal red zone appearances. So this is to me going to be the biggest test right now for this Michigan State pass defense, because Washington's got receivers, they've got a quarterback who can deliver the ball, and they've got a coach who knows how to put it in the right guy's hands in the right scheme. So I think that I would be, this isn't just about the first few weeks. This is still going back to last year. You got to show it against a Power Five opponent that you can stop the pass, and plain and simple.
And I also think that, there's a little bit of a misnomer when you're a fan of a high major, that like somehow the players are sort of robots and are just that much better and quicker than a mid-major opponent. They're not going to – like there are pros on mid-major rosters all over the place and really good players who create matchup problems for you. I mean, the team Michigan State played first, Western Michigan, has had more highly rated receivers in the last decade plus than Michigan State. They've had more NFL – I don't know, more NFL quarterback, whatever. But anyway, they've had just many. The Mac's got tons of quarterbacks in the NFL, right? I mean, you know, way back to Charlie Batch and Roethlisberger and whatever. I mean, it's Leftwich. I mean, there are good players everywhere, and DJ Irons is one of them. And when he went out, they could do nothing. But he's a guy that can create some trouble, and they have enough there with transfers and talent to. I think most teams in the country would give up a little here and there to Akron while they were trying to figure it out. What will be interesting is Chris astutely mentioned the being a poor man's Michael Penix, and I think they're aware too that they got to look at a little bit of what they're going to face, and in terms of sequencing of opponents, that was pretty good timing.
Alan Perlstein asks, on a fundamental level, is Scotty Hazleton's defense a bend-but-don't-break defense no matter who's playing? I couldn't help but notice the same soft coverages against Western Michigan and Akron that we had 2 years ago. Graham?
Well, they're certainly not playing a press sort of deal, right? And I don't know if they just don't think they have the guys to do that. So I think they're playing to their personnel. But it's a fair question. I think it is we get deeper into this season and get a better look at what's what now. You know, you're playing with without Xavier Henderson for the first time, so you're maybe a little wary in the stuff you're doing early. Maybe you're trying to figure things out, but there definitely were some soft coverages early on last week, and I don't know if that's inherent to everything he'd love to do. Like, the question is, if Darquez Denard and Trey Wayne show up and you see that same sort of stuff, then it's like, hey, man, like, these guys, what are we doing here? But I think he's playing to what he thinks is best for that defense.
I don't think it's necessarily even bend and don't break either, mind you. I think it's keep the plays in front of you as much as possible, if not always. I mean, their philosophy is they don't want to get beat deep. Plain and simple, you know, you don't want to give up the explosive plays down the field in the pass game with this defense, and you need to have the ability to wrap up over the middle. I mean, that's what got them a lot of times last year, is the stuff over the middle, those crossing routes, and you know, the times when the linebackers are too shallow and the safety's too deep, and you know, those kind of mixes, you know, and matches that they were hoping to have with Darius Snow. I think it's going to be an interesting and fascinating case to see maybe even how much Snow was going to mean to that defense with what Indiana does, what Washington does with those guys. I say Indiana because those guys did that. I mean, Penix was able to hit deep after softening up the middle in those games. So through the air. So that's I think something to kind of keep in mind is as much as it's, you know, we talk about the defensive backs, it's the linebackers and coverage too as well. I think this is a big game for a guy like Aaron Brulé to come in and say that he is a guy who can go out and cover and kind of give them what they thought they were going to have with Darius Snow moving down.
All right. My final question is a basketball-related question, and it comes from Zach Brooks. He asked, am I hyperbolic for thinking Jaden Akin's foot surgery is a disaster for this team? Between the early season schedule and his explosive style of play, a foot seems like serious trouble.
Get your drinking game ready for the first Russell Bird reference.
Yeah, no, here's the thing, and it does feel like, you know, I mean, MSU's had a number of stress fracture, stress reaction type injuries throughout the years, and some of them have gone poorly. The most recently, and foot injuries in general, with what happened with Joshua Langford and never really recovered. And there's been some guys who probably came back when they shouldn't have and were never right. It's always concerning. And I think if you were to survey the rest of the country, there are probably other programs that feel the same way, similar injuries. Not everything's been a disaster. You know, Miles Bridges had this same sort of thing, a stress reaction in the foot as his sophomore. They called it an ankle sprain at the time, but it was a stress reaction. And I don't think his, you know, agent or people or whatever wanted it. I guess he didn't have an agent yet, but you know what I mean? They pre-NBA, they didn't really want that out there. And he was fine within, you know, 4 weeks or so. So I do think that, I mean, the timeline, if everything goes perfectly, isn't that bad. It's like 4 weeks, and then you're, you know, still 3-4 weeks for the season, and in theory you're okay. But also, November is a pretty unforgiving schedule, and for a guy that they touted, I mean, they have not been shy about their hopes for what Jaden Akins will be this season. That's a difficult injury. Better timing now than December, but you know, we'll see if it derails his year.
Well, what Graham said, I mean, obviously the two that come to mind are Joshua Langford and Russell Bird, the aforementioned Russell Bird. They had basically their careers altered. So that's in Michigan State fans' mind. But I mean, these kind of injuries happen across the country all the time. Some guys come back from it. It's a lot about your body makeup and how you handle it and how you physically can handle it. And I guess we won't really know until Akins gets back on the court and you kind of see where he's at. A couple of weeks, obviously the surgery, anytime you hear surgery, you should be a little bit concerned. I think that's just the nature of an injury like that. When you hear it, it's not just rest and recovery. It's that we need to have a medical procedure. But they're also confident that he'll be back in 4 weeks and return to full health. They were adamant about that. So the staff believes that this isn't anything like those other injuries. And I think you have to kind of take that on a case by case basis. And, you know, again, once you see, you know, early November, when they get into those exhibition games, see where he's at. I mean, he had a full summer, which I think is important. We saw him out at Moneyball. He was doing things there. So this is obviously something that was not enough of a factor to keep him off the court all summer. So he had that summer development, which is, I think, a critical thing.
And, you know, Mateen Cleaves had an injury similar to it, and they won a national championship that year, came back and had a heck of a Big Ten season. So, you know, I mean, not every one of these has been disaster. I mean, I think there's a little, you know, PTSD from the recent ones, and Langford was certainly one that was, you know, just continually bad news. I mean, I feel like I can remember every, like, Izzo press conference that began with him walking in glumly about the latest update about Joshua Langford. And so that there is that sort of, and I think that, you know, it happens with everything. It happens with Brian Lewerke's development. So now Peyton Thorne isn't going to get any better. It happens with anything where it happened, you know, Mark D'Antonio lost steam. So that's what's happening to Tom Izzo. You know, like, there is sort of a reaction because you've seen it in something you care about recently. And, but one does not necessarily make the other.
Well, it actually goes with something that Mel Tucker said this week. And when pro scouts come in and look at guys, they ask them, who do you compare them to? I mean, that, you know, you compare situations, you compare talent level, skill level, performance, production, all those things. I mean, that's just the nature of sports. I think, I don't think it's, you know, right or wrong. Fans, obviously, that's what they know. You know, that they know those injury histories of Langford and Russell Bird, because, you know, those were guys that had high expectations and, you know, it derailed it. So, I think that's just human nature. But, you know, you also have to take it from, you know, every test case is individual and different. Just like, you know, no one knew what Kenneth Walker would be until Kenneth Walker was. So can't take that however you want to take it.
All right. Well, let's move on to predictions for Saturday's game. Graham, I'm going to start with you.
Strangely, I've gone back and forth here. And I've landed on Michigan State, and I mean, I can picture this going poorly because I can picture the best of Michael Penix, right? And I do think, like, I mean, I like what Michigan State's done in the running game. I think Peyton Thorne will play well. There are two things that I think this comes down to. One, if Jaden Reed doesn't play, this prediction doesn't count. If for some reason he doesn't play, and we have no information that he won't, it's just that, you know, Mel Tucker basically said he was sore and he'll be ready when he's ready. And that's the same injury when a guy has knee surgery as when a guy has a cut on his back. So, like, it's, you just don't know for sure. Because I do think the trickle down from losing him and where Thorne is and the comfortability with him, I think could be problematic. The other thing is,
am I wrong? If the line flipped pretty quickly and violently the other way, from MSU to Washington. I had heard that, but yeah. I also know that Vegas Insider had some issues with seeds before, so.
Well, no, I mean, like, Circa had it -3 for MSU, right? And basically went 3.5 the other way. But Circa puts its lines way out there. I mean, it's sort of taking a risk. It doesn't, like, the way odds makers work when they do their lines, usually they're all pretty much in unison. Circa wants to be first, and so they're a little, so it's not always, yes, you could bet Circa if you're right and ready to go, but most lines you could bet never were ever -3 for MSU. Like, most sports books never offered that line. And so, but that said, like, the other thing is, if they don't get to Penix, if he's able to pick them apart, this is a really difficult game. My sense is they'll be able to get to him a little bit. I think Washington's offensive line is proven. I think MSU's got more playmakers, and I don't know. I just, for whatever reason, my gut is gone there, and I have it at 31-24 MSU.
That's interesting. I'm looking at the over-under, and it looks like that's set right around 56.5 right now. I'd play the over on this because I think there's going to be a lot of offense. Like, I see this, you know, I see both of these teams. If Penix is in the game, if Reed is healthy, I think both of these teams can put up some points on each other. I still think that, you know, even though Michigan State says last year doesn't matter, it's a new season, a new journey, it does matter because you've proven to the veteran guys that were on that field in Miami and in the Peach Bowl and any other number of games that they were able to go and win a game that sometimes, you know, you were down, and even the Michigan game, you know, games that you thought that, you know, could go the other way or were a coin flip, they were able to pull out for the most part. So, you know, I think, you know, in looking at this, I'd probably put it like maybe a 33-28 or 33-30 kind of game for Michigan State, kind of winning in a little bit of a shootout.
I'm with you guys. I like Michigan State to win. Not only do I like Michigan State to win, I like them to cover also, as you guys have done as well. And they're like, I think it's my best bet of the entire college football slate. I'm willing to go that far. I think I'm kind of in on what, even with the Snow and Henderson injuries, I kind of think I'm in with what I'm seeing with Michigan State so this season. I think there's a chance they go in there, win by double digits. I'm just willing to, just throwing that out there.
I mean, that is a hot take right there.
I know. Especially coming from me, who is always pessimistic most of the time.
Wow. I'm impressed.
Thank you. All right. Any final thoughts before we sign off here?
It's just fun to have a game like this where, you know, I mean, you wait for a long time for the football season to begin, but then there's like a second season that comes when the games are actually like win or lose is up in the air to be decided, right? And that's, I think, a fun part of it where people's anxiety goes up. Real football season has started, so to speak. Now it has for certain other programs already, but for MSU it'll start now. And for Michigan, I think sometime in November they play somebody, so their schedule will start at some point too.
Michigan State before November. Yeah. I don't know. My only final thoughts is I got to hurry up and go get some compression socks and download some new podcasts so I only sleep a half hour on the flight.
And on that note, thank you for joining us for this edition of Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and the USA Today Network. If you enjoy this podcast and the work surrounding it, please consider subscribing. You can follow our coverage at lsj.com, freep.com, and on Twitter at Chris Solari, at Graham_Couch, at Phil_Friend, and LSJ Greenwhite. Thanks for listening.